So my talk today will be on screening, brief intervention, and outpatient treatment for adolescent substance abuse in the medical setting. And I'm going to be presenting what we've done at Children's Hospital Boston. I'll start by saying I have no disclosures. I'd like to have some, actually. So if anybody has money, would like to corrupt me, let's talk after. Okay. By way of background, and we've heard a lot of this, but we know that misuse of narcotic medications or opioids by U.S. adolescents and actually other so the population as well is on the rise. We know that teens as well as adults believe that use of opioids is safe even without a prescription. And opioids have become a new gateway drug. So when we look at what drug do adolescents first initiate drug use with, opioids are climbing, getting closer and closer to marijuana. It's actually an interesting change in how kids enter the whole world of drug use. But unfortunately, because of their high addiction potential, many teens who experiment with opioids quickly become addicted. And for some individuals, this may occur after just a small number of uses or even just a single use. Anecdotally, I treat adolescents who are under the age of 21, and I have patient after patient tell me that after their first time, they knew that they were addicted. It's a frightening story, and it really emphasizes the need for screening in the medical home, because we want to catch these kids as soon as possible after initiation and make interventions as soon as possible. So I'm going to be talking about SBIRT, screening and brief intervention, referral to treatment. Basically, this is a framework for identifying and treating substance use in a general medical setting. SAMHSA coined the term SBIRT about 10 years ago and has since pumped a lot of money into SBIRT, into grants that allow medical centers to do widespread screening, to hire the staff that they need for demonstration products, and more recently, a medical residency training program so that we could teach our doctors in training how to do this work. SBIRT actually was initially thought of as a way to find and treat primarily adults who are risky or at-risk drinkers, and it works very well in this population. There's a question of whether it's efficacious for drug use in adults. However, in adolescents, I don't think that there's any question. I think it's really, the data that's coming out looks like it's quite effective in adolescents, and you can screen for alcohol and drug use simultaneously. And we know from the data that it's really very important to screen, especially adolescents and young adults for drug use as well. So Dr. John Knight has led some research at Children's Hospital, where I'm from, and he's demonstrated efficacy in decreasing alcohol initiation and increasing alcohol cessation rates among adolescents who are presenting for primary care with some really pretty simple techniques. And of course, I just said it's effective for drugs, but he's really shown that it's been effective for alcohol. And I'll tell you, I'm not going to show the data today, and it's still being analyzed and presented. It looks like it was quite effective for marijuana as well. But because this was a primary care population, the project was not big enough to be powered, even though there was a large effect size for marijuana. It was not powered for detecting significant differences. Okay, this is the results of a statewide physician survey on screening and brief intervention for all pediatricians and family family physicians, done in 2007 in the state of Massachusetts. And this is unpublished data, but what it shows is that primary care physicians, they like SBIRT. They think it's a good idea. Over 90% of them agreed that primary care physicians should screen adolescents for alcohol and other drug use. About 70% of them felt that they knew what to do when a screen for substance use problems is positive. And over half of them thought that screening for substance use and brief intervention for adolescents is an effective approach to preventing alcohol and other drug use problems. So this is good news, at least in our state, although I think that this is probably nationally representative. Physicians like the idea of screening. They think it's a good idea, and they think it's a good way to prevent drug problems. And we also asked in the 2007 survey whether physicians screen adolescent patients annually for substance use, and 86% of respondents told us that, in fact, they do. Compare that to 1997, before the SAMHSA initiative, when only 45% of pediatricians in a 1997 survey done by the American Academy of Pediatrics said that they screen annually. This is a very big jump. And so it does really look like the word about screening is really getting out there, and physicians are interested. So that's exciting news. There are some barriers to implementation. There have been a number of studies that cite the barriers. One of them is the time allotted for primary care appointments. Everybody in the audience who practices primary care knows that this is ever shrinking as different interest groups add more and more screenings. And so how do you decide what's most important, or how do you fit them all in? Also, there is an issue of screening tools and physician training, which I'll show you in just a second. And then, as we heard from the audience, there's a question of access to community resources. So particularly when somebody needs a referral to treatment, what do you actually do? So I want to just get back to the idea of screening tools. Again, from the 2007 statewide survey in Massachusetts, we asked physicians, what type of tool do you use to screen adolescent patients for substance use? You can see only about a third of them said that they were using the CRAFT, which is a validated tool with adolescents, both very sensitive and specific for picking up high-risk drug and alcohol use. About 7.5% of them said that they were using the CAGE, which we know and has been shown to publications, is not very sensitive for finding alcohol problems in adolescents, although it's very sensitive and has excellent psychometric properties in adults. It should not be used with adolescents. And nearly 60% said that they were using no tool at all, and this is problematic because we know that physicians largely miss drug use and problems associated with drug use when they screen just based on their informal or gut instincts. In 2008, SAMHSA put out a request for applications for to develop screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment programs to teach medical residents. We were one of 11 projects funded in the first round at Children's Hospital Boston, and I see we're floating a little bit in the ocean there on this map. So, oh no, that's a little bit better than it had been. What was unique about our program is that although a couple of the other programs had included pediatrics and in their application and were planning on training pediatrics residents, we said that we would develop the pediatric-specific tools and disseminate them to the other programs, and also, you know, in a later step, we'll disseminate them more largely so that residency programs who are interested in having their trainees see appropriate materials will have them available to them. So the first thing we did is thinking about the barriers to ESPRT. We thought about ways of making ESPRT a little bit easier to do in primary care, and we developed an algorithm. We used research-informed tools and interventions, things that we know worked. We only used things that had been validated with adolescents for this particular project. We made sure that everything was simple to use and quick. And here is a skeletal version of our algorithm. So it starts by just asking three opening questions about past year alcohol and drug use. We're actually, one question is about past year alcohol use, the next is about marijuana, and the third is about all other drugs. And we're very specific in the small print. We ask them to ask about misuse of prescription and pain medications as well. For adolescents who have not yet initiated, they get positive reinforcement. They get statements such as, I'm really glad to hear you're making such smart decisions about drug and alcohol use. And although this is very brief, and it's fun for pediatricians to give nice feedback like that, it's actually been shown to decrease initiation rates in the next 3 months, and it looks like some of those findings are holding out unbelievably till 12 months. And if you compare kids who heard that message from a physician to those who didn't, they're less likely to initiate. for kids who tell us that they've tried an alcohol or another drug in the past year, we screen them with the CRAFT questions. And those who screen negative get brief advice. And again, it's very, very simple. Things like, such as your doctor, I urge you to stop taking medications that were not prescribed to you. While they may seem safe, pain medications are highly addictive and kids can become addicted even after using just a few times. When you take someone else's medication, you're also at risk of overdose. You do such a great job staying healthy. I hate to see anything that jeopardizes your health. Things that can be said very quickly. What's really important about all of the brief advice that we recommend is that it's tied to medical reasons for not using drugs, and we really stay away from legal prohibitions and other things, because that tends to evoke a lot of resistance in our adolescent patients. But when we talk about medical issues, we actually get a lot of buy-in from the adolescents, because they know that when they're speaking to their physician, they're speaking to an expert on these issues. Okay, so kids who screen positive for high-risk drug use, they get a very brief assessment, just a couple of questions, and what we're looking for are kids who are have signs of acute danger, and these are just samples. All of this captures most of what we see. Anybody who's drinking more than 10 drinks in a session, mixing sedatives, unfortunately mixing alcohol, benzodiazepines, and opioids, has returned to popularity, at least in the Northeast. Anybody who's using IV drugs or driving while impaired is considered acute danger, and we recommend that the physician do an intervention right then and there before the adolescent leaves the room, and that usually involves bringing a parent in and having more of a conversation. We also teach our residents to look for signs of addiction, and basically what we're trying to pick off the highest risk group. So kids who are under 15 years old and screen positive on the CRAFT test, they may not have an addiction, but they're extremely high risk if they don't, and we think that they need further evaluation. Anybody who's reporting daily drug use, alcoholic blackouts, or opioid use is also very high risk of addiction, and we think that those kids need to come back for further assessment, either with the pediatrician or in other cases with a psychologist or mental health worker to get a full diagnostic interview. We put our algorithm on a Parker card. The residents love this. You can't read it from there, but I just put it up there to show you that everything that they need to say or do is printed on this 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, so they can really read it right off. We even give sample brief advice statements and praise and encouragement statements. So we've made it really, really easy for them. They feel like they can master it, and this soon they don't take it out of their pocket, but at the beginning, it's a really easy way for them to do this. We also created a series of core training modules. We selected five areas that we thought residents need more education on. They get an overview of expert techniques. They get a 50-minute presentation on brief interventions. And they also get a module on proper pain prescribing practices for pain medications. We go over a lot of the points that Dr. Baxter brought up. We talk to them about ADHD and substance abuse, and then we talk to them about drug testing. And here is one of our sample modules in our program. These are all delivered as small group lectures, but they've also been converted, because so many of our residents are not able to attend all the lectures, they've also been converted to self-tutorials. So here's a sample of what the slides look like. Our residents wanted case-based teaching, so that's what they got. They get lots and lots of cases with a few points in between, but the cases are, we hope, realistic enough that they all ring a bell as they're going through them. Our physicians really like the curriculum. These are the percent of trainees who agree or strongly agree after a first year of curriculum. You can see they're all over 90%, no matter what we ask them, you know, whether it's the training's been useful or enhances their skills. So it's been very successful. We also test their knowledge after delivery of each of the core curriculum modules, and then again at the end of the year. And you can see those, we've had good results the residents have been mastering the objectives, and that information is pretty much staying with them till the end of the year. But that leaves us with the problem of referral to treatment. So I got from Dr. McClellan's talks in the past that there are more than 9,000 treatment programs in the United States, and he puts this in perspective by saying that's more than there are Starbucks. And actually, I got interested in that statistic, so I looked it up. And sure enough, there are only 8,500 company owns Starbucks in the United States. So these things really, and you know, I have a friend in Manhattan, he says, you know, real estate is so tight that they had to open a Starbucks inside another Starbucks in Manhattan. And, you know, and I thought, well, if there are 9,000 treatment programs, they should just really be everywhere. And, you know, at some level they are, but there are lots of problems associated with them. So, you know, and we know that they all kind of come and go, and whether they take insurance is a real big question mark. And when you're talking about treating adolescent patients, the problems are even bigger. We know that only about half of all of these facilities admit adolescents, and of those, only 18% can serve 10 or more adolescents concurrently. So usually when they admit adolescents, they're really just a few. And 20% of the facilities integrate adolescents with adults, which is not a recommended practice, and only about half have adopted the quality elements recommended by the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment, or CSAT. So both quantity and quality of referral to treatment is a real issue. I know it's an issue for adults. I think it's an even bigger issue when you're treating adolescents. And in fact, again, this is the 2007 survey done in Massachusetts, and we can see we asked, well, what services would be helpful to increase your ESPERT? And the answers that got the largest number of respondents was more substance abuse treatment referrals and more psychological counseling referrals. So physicians really feel like they need help with this. And I want to tell you about the Adolescent Substance Abuse Program at Children's Hospital of Boston. So another thing that has been published in the UNDCP strategy is that we need to bring addictions treatment back into the medical centers, because it is the only medical disease right now that's being treated in a separate and certainly not equal infrastructure. So about 10 years ago, we opened the Adolescent Substance Abuse Program at Children's Hospital. I believe it's the only substance abuse specialty program at a children's hospital in the United States. We're staffed by developmental and behavioral pediatricians, addiction psychiatrists, and master's level licensed independent social workers. So our staff is has significantly more training than what you'll find in the average storefront addictions program. And we've gotten some really good results, and I'm putting them out there because my hope is that one day people will look at these and say, well, actually, why is this the only program at a children's hospital? Why can't we have them in more places? So in 2009, we saw over 300 individuals who completed more than 3,500 visits. And this is probably the most important thing that I'll say today, that since 2005, when we got to be a big enough program to complete about somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 visits a year, we were able to completely support ourselves by clinical revenue. Now, we do practice in the state of Massachusetts, where we have passed healthcare reform legislation before the national reform. And so it's just about everybody should be able to get access to insurance. But I think, and hopefully now with the federal legislation, that this should be possible in other places around the country as well. In terms of services, our program provides multidisciplinary assessment, individual counseling using motivational interviewing or relapse prevention, depending on where we assess the young person to be. We do group therapy programs for opioid-dependent adolescents, who are not opioid-dependent and that they're mostly have problems with marijuana and alcohol. And we also do a continuing care group for adolescents who've completed the first phase and entered the second phase of treatment where they're in a more stable recovery. We run a therapeutic drug testing program. We have an opioid replacement program. We give them psychopharmacology so that they can really have everything in one place. And we do case management for kids and their families. We have a rather large Suboxone program for adolescents, and it consists of directly observed induction in the clinic, and then we teach parents how to observe medication. So parents actually come in and they watch the kids take it, and we answer all their questions. It's not hard. This is a sublingual medication, but inevitably there are questions about how this should be done, and we instruct parents to observe it just like we're observing it in the clinic. We require frequent medication visits, especially in the first couple of weeks to months, where we know that the risk of overdose is highest. We provide psychosocial support for adolescents and their parents. In fact, we require it. We also require drug testing, and we give other individualized services as necessary. And our program results are really quite nice. This is data that I've taken from one of our NIH-funded studies, and you can see that at baseline, on average, our patients have about 57% days abstinent, which means that they're using more than 40% of days. They're using almost every other day on average, and by 9 months, their percent days abstinent as a group has gone up to 84%, so it looks like it's very effective. And if you look, this is just for illicit opioids. On average, again, 81% days abstinent on entry, up to 99% days abstinent by the 9 month. Because we're at an academic medical center and we are staffed with MD and PhD level clinicians, we have been able to undertake some NIH research, and we've actually done randomized controlled trial of some brief interventions, and we're also doing some pilot testing of therapeutic drug testing program for adolescents. And we've also had a number of publications that have come out of the program. And so this really is supposed to be a yes, you can part of the program. I think that our results have been really very good, and I think that they really should be replicable. So I'm hoping that somebody in the audience hears this talk and gets excited about it and starts thinking about what can be done at other institutions. Thank you. Well, a lot of our patients do use AA and NA. I think that it's not for everybody, but a lot of kids do use it and do like it and do find it helpful, and it's completely compatible with the other things that they do with us. A couple of caveats, I think, you know, before I send anybody to AA or NA, especially young people, I really like them to go with somebody. So for our patients, I recommend that they go with an aunt or an uncle if they have somebody in recovery, or somebody who's not necessarily in recovery but would be willing to take them, or in some cases a parent, really just to make sure that they don't find themselves with the wrong people. You know, I think that most people, certainly, you know, the vast majority of people who attend an AA or NA meeting are there for the right reasons. But there's a small minority who may not be there for the right reasons. And the teens, they find those people. So, you know, that's really the risk. And I like them to get sponsors as soon as possible as well.
Are your modules available?
They will be soon, and we're going to be disseminating them. We're going to try and get them. We're interested in a little bit of a peer review process for them, and then we're going to be posting them. I don't know where yet, but probably through a variety of places we'll have links, including the American Academy of Pediatrics website.
I also suggest a site that you can have. There's a website called FMDRL where you can just put up stuff like this, and then it gets peer reviewed.
Right. So that's something that we're going to be pursuing in the next few months. Yes.
Hi, I'm from Massachusetts, and I'm working with the state ESPRIT project. And I just wanted to mention that we have worked with Children's Hospital at the Mass Department of Public Health to put together a pediatric toolkit that uses the CRAFT. And I don't have the website right off the top of my head, but I know it is. We have paper, and we also have an online version of it. So it's not that you know, it's full, but it does talk about the screening process.
Thank you for bringing that up. It has the same algorithm, or it has a very similar version of the algorithm that I showed here today. And also, those similar materials will also be published in American Academy of Pediatrics policy statement within the next couple of months with the same algorithm. Yes. Right, so I think that SAMHSA's goals in the medical residency training program grants are very broad. I mean, I don't think that they're clearly targeting resident MD trainees, but I don't think that they're meant to limit in any way to that specific group. I think they're hoping that these tools get out and that other people will use them and adopt them as well. One of the things that we want to do is get our training modules out so that people who don't happen to have an ESPRT training program nearby will have access to them as well. I actually, there's one other thing that I want to say about our training materials that there was so little training in substance abuse and substance use disorders before our program initiated at the hospital that when the residents finally started seeing these materials, they liked them a lot, and they started realizing what they don't know. So after our first year of training, they started saying, wait a second, you're not covering all the topics. You know, we need to have a specific lecture on marijuana, another one on inhalants, and one on alcohol. Like, we need to know this stuff, because we realize now that we just don't know it. So the chief residents came to us and asked us to add a couple of modules, which we'll be working on for this year.
With the understanding that adult models and adolescent models are not the same, I worked on Samson's ESPRT project, and a lot of nurse and nurse practitioners did participate and deliver brief advice and brief intervention. So.
And although I don't represent HRSA, I can tell you
yes.
that part of the ONGCP's plan is to educate all of the healthcare professionals.
Yes.
Say something about your philosophy on Suboxone when patients want to taper, or how soon you advocate to them.
Yeah, that's a question that comes up all the time that we actually try to address on the first day, because some of the kids, you know, they're really looking to taper very quickly. Others are less sure of it. I don't really think that there's a good scientific answer to this question. So we know that just like methadone, there are people who will probably remain on Suboxone for opioid replacement therapy their whole lives. A lot of kids and parents feel uncomfortable about starting a medication, you know, when you're 16, 15, 16 years old that you might take until you're 85. So we need to talk about it. What we've done is that we've told kids that we like to see them at least 1 year of complete abstinence before we even think about weaning and tapering. And that's really just because we know that the relapse rates, if you look at the relapse rates, they fall throughout the first year. The curve starts to flatten out between 1 and 3 years, and is really pretty flat by 3 years. I'd like them to go longer than one. Many of them choose to. You know, some of them, when a year comes, they feel like they want to, you know, they've moved on, they have a different life now, and they'd like to start to taper. We do it very, very slowly, and there was a recent publication in the past 2 or 3 weeks that showed that the beginning and the ends of treatment are really the riskiest time for people. So when they do go off, we recommend that they go off very slowly, and our average patient who does tapers over 12 months to get them off. And during that entire time, they have a lot of support in terms of, you know, coming to groups and continuing drug testing. Yes?
Are any of you guys aware of any literature on tools to prevent the initiation of drug use? And one of the things about ESPRT, first, it's an identification brief intervention tool. Once drug use has been initiated, the group that I'm working with is looking at early intervention in folks at risk for mental health disorders. And one of the things we're looking at a lot is family history. Are you aware of anything in that? Or any of you guys aware of any tools that are easy to use? And that what I've been doing is, if I identify a family history, I say to the kid, you know, lots of kids try substances. You're at really high risk. And I'm worried about you. You know, I try to make a very personalized message. But I don't know if there's any literature backing up that helps.
Well, I don't know of any curriculum that addressed that as specifically as an issue. I mean, it sounds like a very good idea, and I know that there are people thinking about what could we do for kids with ADHD, where the rates of substance use disorders is so high as compared to the general population, but I haven't seen anything published yet. I don't know if anybody else has.
Yeah, there are some traits that they talk about and still, involved with some sort of activity, sports, family, meals. Those I don't know exactly, but there is actually a list of about 25 things that you can do
prevention or Samson's boot, because there are some materials there.
I have a question. How do you determine when you're going to use a Suboxone or Subutex form?
Well, we talk about it with all kids who present with opioid dependence, and it's really left up to patient and family. But we, because of the data that we've seen, where we know relapse rates are very high in untreated patients, we recommend it, particularly if an adolescent has had relapses or is or is having cravings. We really almost always use the Suboxone. We use the mono product very infrequently. We have one patient who's had allergy, and so we use the mono product for her. And I think that it's still recommended in pregnancy to use straight buprenorphine. But other than that, everybody goes on Suboxone. Yes?
Just to add a point, the disadvantages of Suboxone in pregnancy is more theoretical than real, whereas there have been reports of women who have been subject to violence because Subutex has so much more abuse potential than Suboxone. So some people, despite the labeling, are using Suboxone.
I think that's a complicated issue because the real recommendation is that you transfer them over to methadone, and I mean, I think all of those things are hard to do, so it falls into clinical judgment. I think that as a program, with the new indication for naltrexone, we're going to start making that available to patients as well and letting them choose among their options.
All righty. I want to thank everyone for coming to the session.